An international workers' rights group criticizes Foxconn.
And what employees have to say about working conditions in Foxconn factories.
From APM, American Public Media, I'm Jeremy Hobson in Los Angeles.
And I'm Stacey Vanek Smith in New York. It's the Marketplace Midday Update, our podcast from Marketplace.org. It's Friday, March 30th.
Coming up, will IBM CEO hit the grass ceiling?
And the trillion-dollar question, who is going to pay for college?
You'll hear about it all coming up on the Marketplace Midday Update.
Balance your life with dollar signs. Tune into Marketplace Money this weekend for a look at the issues affecting your wallet. Whether it's investing, renting an apartment, or sending your kid off to college, we'll help you navigate.
Tech manufacturing giant Foxconn, which makes many Apple products in China, has promised workers a pay raise and shorter hours. That after the Fair Labor Association released a report criticizing conditions at Foxconn factories.
Marketplace's Rob Schmitz joins us now from Shanghai, where he's spoken with Foxconn workers. Hi, Rob.
Good morning, Stacey.
You've spent this week talking to Foxconn factory workers. What are they saying?
Well, the workers I spoke to would all love a pay raise, but they're a little suspicious. Back in February, workers at a Foxconn factory in Shenzhen that I spoke to told me they'd received emails from Foxconn telling them then that they'd get around a 20% pay raise starting in March. I went back to the same factory this week, and I've discovered that most workers have not gotten that pay raise. Here's another interesting thing. Rumors travel fast in a factory town. Local landlords who rent their apartments to Foxconn workers have found out about this alleged pay raise. And many workers I spoke to said their landlords have now raised their rents because they thought all their tenants would be getting this raise. So for many workers, they haven't received a pay raise, and now their rent's going up. And they're angry for a lot of reasons. Here's a Foxconn worker, Lei Xibin.
If they give us a raise, they'll make us work less overtime. I'm from a very poor village. I came here to work overtime. When we work overtime, it's a government rule that we receive time and a half. I'm here to make money.
Okay, this worker says he wants overtime, but because of the Fair Labor Association report findings, Foxconn's promised to reduce overtime, which seems like kind of a disconnect here.
Right. And all the workers I spoke to at Foxconn have, you know, they've traveled hundreds of miles from their home villages to Shenzhen, many for the sole reason of making as much money as possible. So overtime is pretty important to them. But the auditors who conducted this investigation surveyed 35,000 Foxconn workers, and they found that workers' attitudes about overtime starts to turn negative after they work around 52 hours a week. So the takeaway here is that, yes, workers do want overtime, but generally they want it in small doses.
You spoke to dozens of Foxconn workers who assemble Apple products. How do they feel about their work and their working conditions inside the factory?
Well, overall, the message I got was compared to other factories that these workers would be qualified to work at, Foxconn was at or near the top of the list of places they wanted to work. So in that sense, they were happy. But that doesn't mean they don't have complaints, mostly centered around how their immediate supervisors make them work hours they don't want to work or how their bosses don't listen to their concerns about the workplace. Many workers I spoke to said that the cost of living in Shenzhen has risen so high that they didn't see the point in staying there. Mm-hmm. Many workers told me that they were planning to return to their home villages and eke out a living there because they figured out they'll save more money that way. And it's sort of interesting, you know, big companies like Foxconn have already anticipated this and have in recent years built new factories further inland closer to where these workers come from.
Marketplace's own China correspondent Rob Schmitz joining us from Shanghai. Thank you, Rob.
Thanks, Stacey.
Rob broke the story about false claims regarding Foxconn factories. You can hear his reports at our website, marketplace.org.
Consumer spending was the big surprise of the morning here in this country. The government said American consumers spent 0.8% more in February. And that's where we'll start now with Chris Lowe. He is chief economist with FTN Financial, and he joins us from New York. Good morning.
Good morning.
So kind of surprising for some people, why this big rise in consumer spending?
It was quite surprising. It was across the board. We had an increase of 1.5% in durable goods spending, with car sales leading the way there, but non-durables was up, and so was service spending.
And what's going on there, Chris? Because you'd think that with these rising gas prices that consumers would be cutting back on their spending a little bit.
Well, that's exactly right. And part of this is consumption of gasoline, and that's offset by the price rise. So you have to sort of dial it back by 0.3 to adjust for that. But still, with spending on cars and restaurants and so on, I think part of it is the warmest weather in about 50 years, which also had an impact on the numbers.
That's sending more people out to do a little more spending that they would have held off otherwise on?
Well, that's right. You know, if there's a snowstorm and 3 feet of snow in Boston, for example, that can sort of wreck car sales nationally for the month. And as a result, I think some of the strength is probably going to come out of spending that would have taken place in March and April otherwise. Still, the number's a lot better than expected.
Chris Lowe, Chief Economist with FTN Financial, thanks as always.
Thank you.
The Masters Tournament tees off next week at the exclusive Augusta National Golf Club in Georgia. It's a tradition that CEOs of major tournament sponsors are invited to join the all-male club. Thing is, the CEO of a major sponsor, IBM, is a woman. Jennifer Collins reports on golf and the grass ceiling.
Tradition has it the CEO of major sponsors get to don that timeless symbol of membership at Augusta National.
The green jacket at the Masters.
The golf world is buzzing this week. Will IBM CEO Virginia Rometty get the jacket? IBM and Augusta National won't comment. Marketing consultant Jason Lai is with Hands On Sports.
Obviously, Augusta needs to look at modifying these rules.
Lai estimates IBM's sponsorship is likely several million dollars. Still, John Champion, a consultant with Kurt Salmon, says money may not be enough.
I don't think sponsorship is going to force our hand in terms of who becomes members.
The club only admitted its first black man, Gannett executive Ron Townsend, in 1990. Champion says most of Augusta's members are at the CEO level.
For many companies, it's a key way to entertain and interact with their clients.
And if Rometty isn't invited, she'll need a member, perhaps one of IBM's past CEOs, to accompany her on the course. I'm Jennifer Collins for Marketplace.
Somewhere in this country today, a high school student is going to come running home to see if she's been accepted to college. And then that student and probably her parents might consider the cost. And perhaps they'll decide to borrow the money and add to the nation's $1 trillion of outstanding student loan debt. That is the trillion-dollar problem that worries Democratic Senator Dick Durbin of Illinois, who joins us now. Good morning.
Good morning.
How serious of a problem is this right now?
You know, I think this is the next credit bubble, and unfortunately, Congress has virtually ignored it.
Well, what are they supposed to do about it?
There are several things. First, I think the president was right to call out the institutions of higher learning in his State of the Union address and tell them that this dramatic increase in the cost of tuition and fees is unsustainable. Secondly, the institutions that are involved in this, many of them, particularly the for-profit schools, are luring kids and many times their parents into debt obligations, which basically they'll never be able to repay.
When you say it's the next credit bubble, do you mean that it would have an impact beyond just students who owe this debt on the broader economy the way that the mortgage bubble did?
I'm not sure it'll have the same impact because real estate is such a central part of the economy. But imagine, if you will, thousands of students across America defaulting on their debts, but being stuck with debts that are not dischargeable in bankruptcy.
Well, who's at fault here? Is it the lender? Is it the school that's charging too much? What?
Well, I think it's a variety of things. But basically, the for-profit school industry is driving this train, and unfortunately, it's not going in the right direction. 10% of the students who have graduated from high school are in for-profit schools. Secondly, the for-profit schools receive 25% of all the federal aid to education, and almost 50% of all student loan defaults come from for-profit schools. So this is a trend line which ought to be frightening. But unfortunately, Congress has really refused to respond.
Well, let's talk about a non-for-profit school in your home state and my home state, by the way, the University of Illinois, which is raising tuition about 5% this year. It's gone up 25% in the last 5 years. How are people supposed to be able to afford this?
That's a very valid question. It reflects the fact that the state of Illinois is in terrible shape financially and is not providing assistance to education as it did in the past, particularly higher education. And so these institutions are raising their tuition rates to meet that need. I just think all higher education has spun itself into a level that's unsustainable. I mean, some of the cost here of $10,000, $15,000, $20,000 of debt each year is just considered normal.
Senator Dick Durbin, Democrat of Illinois, thanks so much for joining us.
Good to be with you.
Mark. Marketplace covers the world of economics. Are you ready for some Freakonomics? We're partnering with the team that writes about the hidden side of everything for a regular Marketplace Freakonomics story, podcast, and more. Just go to freakonomicsradio.com.
And now the latest installment from our Wealth and Poverty Desk. Today, the Agriculture Department releases its crop planting predictions for the year. So far, everything points to another good season for Midwestern farmers. We sent reporter Mitchell Hartman to Peoria, Illinois.
Good afternoon. Welcome to the Noon Show here on Classic Country 1290 WIRL. We got a little rain this morning, and we will see if you can get in the field, maybe work some of that ground.
Spring weather has come early to the fields of central Illinois, but the economy's been hot right through the recession.
The economy here is nothing like it is in the bigger, you know, like Chicago. On the farming side, it's been good.
Iced tea, glass iced tea or something? Or
Terry Heft is a third-generation farmer. We met at his ranch house in the rich bottomlands of the Illinois River, where he raises corn and soybeans. He invited some neighbors.
I've never sold $7 corn or $13 beans.
Ron Armbrust says these are the best prices in his 35 years of farming.
It's the one thing about farmers. If they're making money, they're spending money, and so it helps the whole economy.
Credit the weak dollar plus booming demand for U.S. grain in China and the developing world. Still, in farm country, there's no love lost for the politicians who have presided over these good times. Like you'd find in a lot of the Farm Belt, this is a Republican crowd. Lynn Coors manages the local grain elevator. He supports Mitt Romney, though the president gets a nod for the auto bailout.
At least he tried something. You know, I'm not a big Obama fan. He's too liberal for me, but it seemed like it helped.
That sets Armbrust, who backs Rick Santorum, right off.
I knew when we elected Obama that it was going to be big government spending a lot of money.
Are people like you the 1% or the 99%? You're probably in the group that's going to get taxed more if taxes go up.
Yes, with the farm economy going up, that may be where some of us were. You know, I don't mind paying taxes if I thought my money was going to good use. But if we farmed like the government does, we all would have been broke a long time ago.
Armbrust is confident a Republican administration will push back on taxes and regulations that he says make his profitable farm business a little less profitable every year. I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
Now to the global perspective on business and economics. European finance ministers are meeting in Denmark today. They're reportedly adding $670 billion to their bailout fund. Ministers have been trying to figure out how big of a financial bazooka they need to defend Europe from speculators. Marketplace's Stephen Beard reports from London.
When speculators began attacking the Eurozone 2 years ago, dumping government bonds, the Eurozone's initial response was widely seen as feeble. They lobbed the equivalent of a couple of grenades. But the battle intensified. The Europeans wheeled out what they called their big bazooka, a multi-billion dollar bailout fund to buy up the beleaguered bonds and blow the speculators away. Now the fund is running low on ammunition. Ministers are talking about creating a much bigger fund. Here's Simon Tilford of the Centre for European Reform.
If the Eurozone doesn't do anything else to get the southern Eurozone economies growing, they will need a very, very big bazooka indeed.
Perhaps, he says, a bailout fund worth as much as $1.5 trillion. Not so much a bazooka as a ballistic missile. In London, I'm Stephen Beard for Marketplace.
Bee populations in the U.S. and in other parts of the world have been on the decline, which has many people worried. Well, now two new studies may have figured out the reason why.
Here to talk with us in today's Midday Extra is Jeff Pettis. He's a researcher of bees at the U.S. Department of Agriculture, and he joins us now. Hi, Jeff.
Hi, good morning.
Well, tell us what these new studies have found and how this changes what people thought about what might have been happening to the bees.
Sure. Pollinator decline has been a kind of a worldwide issue, and we've always looked at habitat destruction as being a major driver, major impact on why pollinators are declining. And these studies combined have shown that an impact on reproduction, of, in particular bumblebees in this case. And so it kind of changes the equation that this low-level pesticide exposure, which we know is happening at some level, could be drastically affecting pollinator health.
Well, these pesticides have been in use for a long time. Why do you think we're seeing the effects of them on bee populations now?
Well, again, we've designed better studies to look at what we call sublethal effects. In the past, we've looked for lethality. Did the products actually kill bees? And In this case, we're looking for sublethal effects, which are harder to uncover. And these two studies do a nice job of uncovering some of those impacts that could be going on. And in particular, in the bumblebee study, they showed a direct impact on the reproduction. That colony would not have produced very many queens to found the next year's population. So it was pretty dramatic.
And if this is the reason behind what we're seeing, does that make it more concerning or less concerning?
Well, I have to clarify a bit. It raises the level that pesticides are probably playing. In other words, there's still habitat destruction and many other things, pathogens and pests that affect a lot of pollinators. But it raises the conversation about the role of pesticides to a much higher level. So it's not like the cause, but it raises our concern over the role of pesticides in pollinator
health. But is it the kind of thing where if we find out that that's playing a major role then, is that the kind of thing where we can react and these pesticides can be used less in certain places?
Well, there's certainly room there for – I'm sorry, go ahead.
Oh, I was going to say like with DDT and bird eggs.
Right.
When I was growing up.
Yeah, I'm not sure. I'm not sure we're at a silent spring moment, but I will say that these two studies raise some of those same questions. Are we doing more harm than good with regard to pollinator health? But we also need agriculture to produce fruits and vegetables and things that we rely on. So there's a balancing act here that I think we probably have to look at.
Well, that brings us to another question, which is explain to us, if you will, why a declining bee population is such a big problem.
Okay. In addition to honeybees and other pollinators in agriculture putting about one-third of our food on the table, a lot of other bees and other pollinators pollinate the natural environment, produce seeds and things for fruits, birds, and things in the natural ecosystem. So there's a natural ecosystem side, but there's also food production side, which is what I work in, and about one-third of our entire diet comes from pollinators.
One-third. So I imagine that that there's going to be at least a strong lobby to make sure that the bees are okay, as much as there may be a strong lobby to make sure that we can still use these pesticides.
Right. No, there's a good balancing act that needs to go on. But I certainly think that without pollinators, you could survive on staples, things like corn, rice, and wheat. They're all wind pollinated. But you thrive on things like that pollinators bring, the fruits, nuts, and vegetables. So, yeah, certainly there's concern. And in addition, actually, somehow people connect with bees. They're not panda bears or polar bears, but they connect with bees. They see them as they're warm and fuzzy, even though they do sting.
Jeff Pettis is a researcher of bees at the U.S. Department of Agriculture. Thanks so much for talking with us.
Thank you very much.
Here in this country, many jobs are being replaced by machines, which brings us to David Brancaccio of Marketplace's Economy 4.0 team. He's currently driving 3,200 miles across the country without interacting with humans. Here's his report on some technology that made the trip possible.
It doesn't have arms or eyes or a voice like this.
I've been trying to overload my power cells and burn out my primary memory banks.
But this kiosk at Hyatt Place Hotels lets you check in with swipes of a credit card. The thing prints your room number and receipt on a thin strip of paper, and out of a slot comes a plastic card so you can let yourself into the room. When Hyatt strung enough of these hotels across the country so I could reach each one in a long day's drive, it made possible this strange idea of a journey across America dealing only with technology. At each of the hotels, I've also found a human receptionist full of customer service enthusiasm, but I've been trying to avoid them without being a jerk. But it's not all smooth sailing. Each time I've tried, it's taken at least 4 swipes to get it to take, and I had to switch to my backup credit card twice.
Okay, after 10 swipes, it worked.
In fact, when I called ahead before the trip, the hotel in Albuquerque told me I'd better get there quick because they're getting rid of their kiosk in a few weeks. The one in Las Vegas had already removed the kiosks. Something about repair costs was the hint. So I had to scout for a competing Westin Element hotel that had one of the bots up and working. Some labor market experts note that robots don't require health care coverage, and in this way technology has an advantage over the human workforce. But at least we don't need a repairman.
Deposit applied. Outstanding balance, 0. That's what we like. Confirm.
To confirm what I was hearing, we reached out to Hyatt. It's official. The company is eliminating the robots. Word is only 2% of travelers are using them, And the company says the guests really like the gallery hosts instead. So here's the news. In the battle versus the robots, the humans have just won a major skirmish in the hospitality industry. On the road, I'm David Brancaccio for Marketplace.
And you can find out tonight on Marketplace if David makes it from coast to coast without talking to any people.
That sounds so lonely. And finally, Jeremy, are you an oatmeal person? Do you eat oatmeal?
Occasionally I'll have some oatmeal, sure.
Well, you're familiar, of course, with the Quaker Oats icon,
oh, yeah.
The black hat, ascot, white hair.
The Ben Franklin-like guy?
Yes. His name is actually Larry, apparently. I know. And he's getting a little a makeover.
Oh.
The Wall Street Journal reports that the Quaker decided he was a bit dated, so they are giving him a makeover. He's slimming down. He's getting a haircut, and he's getting about 5 years shaved off of his age.
Really? What's that about?
I don't know. I feel like, you know, the next thing you know, he's going to be driving a sports car.
Maybe they need to, like, they don't want people to think that oatmeal is going to make you fat and old. I don't know.
It's going to make you young and...
young and hip.
Young and hip, yes.
Oatmeal.
What's younger and hipper than oatmeal?
Indeed. I can't think of anything. In Los Angeles, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
And in New York, I'm Stacey Vanek Smith. This is the Marketplace Midday Update.
This is APM, American Public Media.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.